Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome to another episode of Tombs of Horror. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before I started this, or really started this episode, I just want to thank everybody who listened to this podcast once again. I know my release schedule has been pretty erratic lately. Like I've said before, that's pretty much because I'm back to work after a three-month hiatus due to my accident. And I only have off every other weekend, and on the weeks that I don't have the weekend off, I'm basically working 12 days in a fucking row without a break. And during that period, I really don't feel like sitting down and recording an episode. But, you know, I'm doing my best to get at least one episode out a week, even if it does only come out on the weekend. So yeah, I'm still doing my best, or trying my hardest to keep, you know, a release schedule on the weekends. I haven't really been doing much on the weekends lately, so it's really not a problem. So, I thought I'd open this episode with the return of the weekly horror news. Not much going on once again this week, but there are a couple items that I found kind of interesting. With the success of Scream 5, they have already announced the release for Scream 6, which will be out in theaters in March of next year. And I'm kind of hoping that they're going to lay this franchise to rest pretty soon. Because while their movies are still good, Scream is kind of starting to become Scooby-Doo-ish. And I think that's something they should avoid at all costs. So I'm really hoping that they're going to lay this franchise to rest fairly soon. And they have just released the official plot synopsis and a couple new images of the animated gizmo from the upcoming TV show, or animated TV show, Gremlins Secrets of the Mogwai. I have to admit, when I first heard about this, I was kind of excited because it's been, how long has it been since Gremlins 2 came out? It's been at least over 20 years since Gremlins 2, the new batch, came out, and you know, nothing's been heard of when it comes to anything new Gremlins wise since then. But since I've seen pictures and read the synopsis, I'm really not that excited anymore. It looks pretty kiddie-ish, I guess is the best way to put it. And it's all, of course, done with computers. And I don't know, it looks like a bad old Nickelodeon TV show aimed towards kids. And I really don't know how to feel about this. I guess time will tell when this actually comes out. But as of right now, I'm not all that excited about it anymore. And that's it for the weekly horror news. Like I said, not much going on. But just thought I'd bring those two things to your attention. And that brings us into the episode proper. And for this episode, I thought I'd give to you, dear listener, the Golden Toilet Bowl Awards, which is where I'm going to talk about and caution you guys about watching some of the worst fucking horror movies I have ever seen in my life. And these are going to be pretty bad. Most of them, the majority of them, are going to be. And I'd highly, highly advise not watching them. They'll fucking kill brain cells that they're, Jesus Christ, I'm losing brain cells just talking about it before I even get into the movies. But they will kill your fucking brain cells. They're that fucking bad. And as always, you know, you have every right to like a movie that I talk shit about. You know, if you like it, that's completely fine. Continue liking it. That's your right. But I also have a right to not like and talk shit about a movie, especially if it's fucking bad. And like I've always said, this is my podcast and I'll do what the fuck I want with it. But anyway, let's open the Golden Toilet Awards with 2006's Unrest.
Thank you. Do you believe in spirits?
...14,400 people apply for your positions. You're the privileged few. But know this, I will tolerate no disrespect for the dead.
We got a young one. She's been butchered.
A group of medical students.
Who is she?
She was a prostitute who was caught killing her Johns.
Are about to get a lesson.
I feel a strange presence in the lab. This woman was either murdered or killed herself.
In what the body...
So is this her?
...leaves behind.
It feels kind of warm.
That's impossible. It can't be warm.
You disrespect the body. You enrage the soul.
Oh my God!
I look at her body and I feel something is wrong.
Oh God.
Somebody please help me!
I do not believe in spirits.
My cadaver wants something from me. I better figure out what it is before she kills me too.
Brian, don't open the door.
Brian, don't open it! Oh my God!
I forgot to mention that this episode is probably going to be a two-parter because there's a lot of movies I wanted to talk about, but if I did them all, it'll probably be like a fucking five-hour episode, so I'm going to be splitting it into two parts. But anyway, Unrest is part of After Dark's 8 Films to Die For, and it opens with the scene of a woman who's obviously quite disturbed, looking in the mirror and cutting herself. We then cut to a group of young medical students led by Allison Blanchard going to their Anatomy 101 class. By observing the cadaver she was assigned, she discovers that the body had self-inflicted wounds and also had a child. She soon discovers that there is something wrong with the cadaver, which her and the other three people in her group have nicknamed Norma. Mysterious deaths occur in the hospital, which include the fiancé of one of Allison's team members and several hospital employees. It is later revealed that the cadaver is a person named Alita Kovas, who once led an archaeological expedition on an Aztec sacrificial site. There she uncovered 50,000 bodies, which were offered to... I'm not even going to try to pronounce the fucking name. I'm not even sure I spelt it right. But an Aztec god of fertility and prostitution. Afterwards, she herself became a prostitute and started showing symptoms of mental imbalance. Later in her life, she committed murders and was subsequently put in a mental asylum where she died, presumably by her own hand. Once Allison learns of the true nature of the cadaver, she decides the corpse must return to Brazil to satisfy the Aztec god. After a series of gruesome events, Allison and her classmate slash love interest take Alita's now dismembered corpse and cremate her in the hospital. In the end, Allison heads to Brazil to spread the ashes in an attempt to put the spirit at rest. However, it is suggested in the final scene that the spirit remains in the hospital. This is a horribly boring, slow-moving movie. It kind of seems like it was... like it's made like an after-school special with one or two very cheap jump scares thrown in, kind of like The Forest was. But this is just bad. Not a whole lot of what goes on makes any fucking sense. And the only really good thing about it is that the main character, Allison, is played by Corey English, who isn't at all bad to look at. But it's, like I said, this is very slow moving. It's an hour and a half long, but nothing really happens until about an hour in. And even then, it's really not anything spectacular. And what really bothered me about this movie is, well, the fact that nothing really fucking happens in it at all in the whole fucking movie. But the fact that nobody is particularly concerned that these med students are being killed off, or that any of the fucking, or any of the fucking, or hospital staff are being killed off. They're just like, eh, whatever, not a big deal. And that was just fucking stupid. This movie definitely isn't worth your time. I guess I'd only suggest watching it just to see how bad and boring it really fucking is if you see it on, like, Amazon or Tubi or something like that. It's really kind of a struggle to sit through just because of the long stretches of absolutely nothing going fucking on. I'm not sure what the budget for this was, but it somehow brought in $2.7 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 5 out of 10. Letterboxd a 2.3 out of 5. Rotten Tomatoes a 20%. And I give it a half star just for Corey English. And that leads us into the next piece of shit, 2017's The Bye Bye Man.
He's real. If you say his name, or even think it, he'll come for you.
Just say it, don't think it.
What happened? You're gonna tell me, you know that?
Please don't make me say it. Don't say it, don't think it. If I tell you about him, you and your kids, you're all dead.
Well, house off campus with John Henry and a live-in girlfriend.
Should we do it?
Yeah.
You ready for this?
What the hell is that?
What is it? There's something happening.
He's found us.
Oh. Don't think it, don't say it. The bye-bye man.
And the more you think about him, the closer he gets.
Hey, he's trying to get inside us.
Jesus.
He makes us see things.
Based on the short story, The Bridge to Body Island, in Robert Damon Schneck's book, The President's Vampire, the movie opens in 1969, where a mass murder occurs in Madison, Wisconsin, during which a man kills people on his block. As he shoots the neighbors, he continuously asks if anyone spoke about the name that cannot be said. He repeats over and over, don't say it, don't think it, don't think it, don't say it. We then fast forward to the present day, where Elliot, his girlfriend Sasha, and friend John move into an off-campus house not far from their college. Soon, mysterious things start to happen, such as Sasha developing a strange cough and Elliot finding coins in a nightstand that continually reappear. Elliot also finds writing consisting of don't think it, don't say it, and a name, the Bye-Bye Man. During a seance involving their friend Kim, the name is mentioned. Sasha then continues to become sick as Elliot and John start experiencing hallucinations and strange activity. Elliot begins to suspect that Sasha is cheating on him with John, as Elliot's brother Virgil had said at the party before the Bye Bye Man was released. A librarian shows Elliot a dossier about the Bye-Bye Man, and a teenager killed his family and told a reporter that the Bye-Bye Man made him do it. The same reporter later became a mass shooter during the 60s, who killed himself after realizing people knew about the Bye-Bye Man. Kim is killed when she is struck by a train, and Elliot is taken in for questioning by Detective Shaw, and is released when Kim's suicide note reveals she killed her roommate and was planning on killing Elliot, Sasha, and John. Elliot also then visits the widow of the reporter, who reveals that the curse causes insanity, hallucinations, and eventually death. Signs of his coming are signs of the Bye-Bye Man's coming are coins mysteriously appearing, sounds of a train, and a large skinless hound. The only way to prevent it is to not think of his name or speak of him. If someone already knows, they must be killed. The librarian is then hit by Elliot's car by accident after she killed someone in her home and is coming for Elliot next. Sasha and John are also suffering from hallucinations, and Elliot finds John stabbing Sasha. He shoots John, but after he picks up the corpse, Sasha is revealed to have been stabbing John. The Bye-Bye Man then appears, and Elliot hallucinates. Elliot then keeps Virgil and his daughter Alice away long enough for him to kill himself with a gun, and Virgil and Alice get away before the entire house goes up in flames. Then, while riding home, Alice reveals she found the coins from the nightstand near the trash, along with the writing, but she could not read it due to her poor night vision. Detective Shaw arrives at the scene, where John is found to still be alive, but wounded. John then whispers the name to Shaw, allowing the Bye-Bye Man's curse to spread again, and the movie ends. This movie is proof that just because you can make a PG-13 rated horror movie, definitely doesn't mean that you fucking should. Everything in this is just terribly bad. You know, the story is stupid. The characters act unbelievably retarded. And the opening scene made me... It's not supposed to be funny at fucking all. But I laughed for fucking 20 minutes at it. It's just that bad. You know, it's not even... It doesn't even fall under the so bad, it's good category. This is just fucking bad. No, the acting is alright. It's probably better than it deserves. But the CGI is fucking horrible. Most of it just looks like it was unfinished. It's just really bad. And I can't say to stay away from this fucking movie enough. It's pretty fucking bad. This had a budget of $6.7 million, even though I'm not really quite sure why, and somehow managed to bring in $27.7 million at the box office. There has also been rumors of a sequel to this, but thank God nothing has ever surfaced. IMDb gave it a 5 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 18%, Letterboxd, a 1 out of 5, and I give it a big fat fucking 0 out of 5. Next up, we have 1985's Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf. Supposedly based on, but in all actuality, having close to absolutely nothing to do with Gary Bradner's novel, The Howling 2, the movie opens with Ben White attending the funeral of his sister, journalist Karen White, who was played by Dee Wallace in the first film and was the movie's heroine. Following her interment in a mausoleum, Ben meets both Jenny Templeton, who was one of Karen's colleagues, and Stefan Krasko, who is played by horror great Christopher Lee, a mysterious interloper who tells him Karen was a werewolf, providing videotaped evidence of the transformation and turning up to destroy Karen as her undead body rises from the grave. Krasko invites Ben and Jenny to accompany him to Transylvania to battle Sturba, an immortal werewolf queen. Along the way, the trio encounter Marina, another lusty werewolf siren, and her minion, Earl. Arriving in the Balkans, Ben and company wander through an ethnic folk festival, unaware that Sturba is off in her nearby castle, already plotting their downfall. Sturba seems to have powers of witchcraft, as well as being a werewolf. Fortune tones the Wiccan chant, Echo Echo Azarek. Eventually, the adventurers battle with Sturba in an assault that involves disguised dwarfs, mutilated priests, and supernatural parasites, before Sturba is destroyed by Stefan at the cost of his own life. Ben and Jenny then return home, where they become a couple and are greeted by a werewolf disguised as their neighbor's child. They go to the neighbor's house and ask about the child, to which the neighbor replies that he has no child, confirming their suspicions that the child was, in fact, a werewolf, and the movie thankfully ends. The fact that Christopher Lee, who is one of horror's, or was one of horror's greatest actors, said that the only reason he appeared in this was because he'd never been in a werewolf movie before, should probably give you enough evidence to steer clear of this. I mean, it's a fucking horrible movie, and the problems with this are great. First off, the acting is worse than pitiful. Christopher Lee is decent enough, but that's kind of where it ends. And the two main characters are lacking in pretty much everything you'd want in a main character. The writing is amateurish and beyond fucking stupid. And while there are one or two nice-looking special effect gimmicks, the cheesy ones far outweigh the good ones. And the cheesy ones are pretty fucking bad at that. And also, for some fucking reason, I can't really understand why, the end credits have a scene where Sybil Danning is ripping off her top, not once, not twice, but like five different fucking times for really no fucking particular reason. And I mean, it's not like it's, you know, different scenes of her doing it. It's one continuous scene played in a fucking loop over and over again. And for the fucking life of me, I can't figure out why the fuck they decided to do this. Just to prove how retarded this fucking movie really is, I have no idea. But it's just an extremely stupid fucking way to end a movie, even though back then, Sybil Danning wasn't that bad to look at. IMDb gave it a 3.6 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 31%. Letterboxd a 2.4 out of 5. And I give it a half a star out of 5. And next up, we have the god-awful fucking 2005's Day of the Dead 2, Contagium.
Yeah. Luca, what's going on?
Listen, the thing they brought in here, don't go near it. People have changed and they're all screwed up and acting loony. Maybe we should call Sergeant Teller.
What for?
It's his project. He knows what's going on. This time I'm not going to walk away and forget.
Don't do anything stupid.
Now, if you've listened to past episodes where my sometimes co-host, Jerry Hartman, a.k.a. Animus Morgue, has appeared, you might have heard us talking about this and this being one of his favorite fucking movies, even though for the life of me, I can't figure out fucking why, because it fucking sucks. But anyway, improbably described as a prequel and a sequel as well to the original Day of the Dead, the movie opens in 1968, where an infected Soviet man, Rubinsky, is being operated on at a military hospital when soldiers arrive and begin to shoot all of those who are in the building. One of the hospital students steals a strange vial, enclosing it in his thermos, and he is later shot by the soldiers as he attempts to escape through the woods and the thermos is dropped. The soldiers in the hospital continue to kill anyone that has been in contact with the infected man, and the zombies are killed when C4 is detonated by sharpshooters outside the hospital. 37 years later, a group of patients at the same hospital, consisting of Boris, Jackie, Isaac, Sam, and their doctor Don Wynn, uncover a strange thermos buried in the soil in the yard of the hospital. Sam attempts to open it, but they are unable due to its being rusted shut. Donwin entrusts Sam with keeping it safe, but Isaac feels that something bad will happen if the thermos is opened. While Sam and Boris are distracted while watching a movie, Jackie sneaks away with the thermos and runs to the bathroom to open it. Sam discovers that Jackie stole the thermos, and with Boris, Isaac, and Emma, they go to the bathroom to talk him out of opening it. Jackie opens it anyway, and a strange object falls from it, unknowingly releasing a virus infecting the entire group. Dr. Heller talks to Donwin about his patient's behavior and claims that Jackie and the other patients are breaking the rules of the hospital. That night, those who were in the bathroom begin to show signs of sickness, and Donwin contacts a friend about the item that was in the thermos. The next day, Donwin awakes to discover Sam having a seizure, and the rest discover that they all have skin on their bodies that is dead and peeling. Emma has tests ran on her, and the results of her tests say that she is pregnant. Emma then attacks Marshall when he keeps bothering her about the results of her test, and she bites him on the arm, infecting him. Sam, Jackie, and Boris begin to show advanced signs of infection, which includes rotting flesh, varicose veins, and coughing up blood. Marshall is then quarantined because of the infection from the bite, and Dr. Heller puts the hospital under full quarantine and gives the doctors the right to bear arms, along with orders to shoot anyone from Dorm 1 in the head that attacks them. Donwin then receives a video from his friend who says not to open the thermos because it contains a deadly virus that mutates human DNA. Donwin then informs Sam that he plans to visit the hospital the next day, and Marshall dies of his infection that night. Next morning, everyone is called to the front desk of the hospital to receive a vial of medicine. Ava informs Donwin that the virus is flesh-eating and kills its host. Patty and Vicky get into a fight, which is broken up by Derber. And Pete senses that Donwin smells dead and goes crazy. This gives Patty a chance to steal one of Derber's handguns and escape to see Emma. Patty then shoots and kills one of the security guards in order to open Emma's room, and Marshall reanimates as a zombie and kills Dr. Heller, who has stopped in to study advancement of the infection. Donwin has by then jumped out of a window to try to find out why the hospital is quarantined and observes the killing of Heller. While trying to find Emma, Patty shoots Isaac, but he revives and is unharmed. Marshall then breaks free from his cell and kills the security guard. Donwin's friend then arrives at the hospital just as Donwin returns to the hospital and informs the patients of what the virus truly is and how it works. He also reveals that each of them are dead, quote-unquote, by human standards. He also reveals that those infected with the virus are highly contagious and informs the patients of how the virus was first released. The zombified Marshall is then shot to death by the hospital's police force, and Jackie attacks Donwin's friend and slams his head into the door, opening a wound. Boris, no longer able to contain his bloodlust, mutates into a zombie and bites him, causing Jackie and Sam to attack him as well. The three then devour him while Isaac, Donwin, and Emma run to the doctor's office outside of the dorm, and Jackie, Sam, and Boris have completely turned to zombies, and they taunt the surviving patients from inside the dorm. Early the next morning, Dr. Heller has reanimated as a zombie, and he enters the room where Vicky is hiding, but he is distracted by the infected Charlie, who he chases away. The patients in the dining room all reanimate as zombies and begin to devour the police officers. The survivors then escape into the kitchen of the hospital, but are forced to retreat into the back hallway. Patty finds Vicky in the medical room and kills her while searching for Emma. Meanwhile, the majority of the zombies escape from the hospital and head out into the city, and the survivors manage to reach the medical room, where Emma goes into labor and the last police officer is killed. The zombies then begin to kill people in the city, Charlie among the victims. Boris, Jackie, and Sam then break into the room, attacking Isaac. Emma and Donwin try to convince them that they don't want to hurt any of them, that they just want them to turn and be a family. And Boris kills Ava, and Isaac commits suicide with the last round of a pistol, and the movie thank fuck ends with the zombies attacking a camera crew recording the carnage. So you might be saying, but Dustin, this sounds like a million other zombie movies out there, so why do you hate it so much? Well, number one, it basically pisses all over George A. Romero's name. It was directed by the two pieces of shit that directed and ruined the Creepshow franchise name with Creepshow 3. If you've ever seen that steaming pile of shit, you'll understand what I mean. But this is just a horrible, horrible, horrible fucking movie. It doesn't have one redeeming point in it. The acting fucking sucks. The special effects fucking suck. The zombie effects fucking suck. The gore fucking sucks. It's all just complete shit. It's a complete waste of fucking time to even try to watch this. When I first became aware of this movie and tried to watch it, it took me 5 fucking times before I could sit through the first 15 minutes of this movie without turning it off. It's just that fucking bad, guys. Do not watch this. Don't listen to Animus. Do not fucking watch this movie. IMDb gave this a 2.3 out of 10. Doesn't even chart on Rotten Tomatoes. Letterboxd gave this a 1 out of 5, and I give this a fucking 0 out of 5. Next, we have 2018's just as fucking bad, Day of the Dead, Bloodline.
You leave tomorrow at dawn. And you come right back. No sightseeing, no sidetracks.
Lord, make me a channel of thy peace. Where there are shadows, I may bring light. Where there is discord,
use chase supply runs so people don't die for nothing.
It wasn't for nothing. Just relax.
My job is to keep people safe, and I decide how that's done.
Where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Lord, grant that I seek.
His brain is still working. They're learning.
Lord,
the second remake of 1985's Day of the Dead. The first Day of the Dead released in 2008. This Bloodline opens with medical student Zoe Parker reluctantly attending a party at her medical school at the behest of her friends. While retrieving a keg of beer from the morgue, Zoe is confronted by her disturbed patient Max, who is obsessively in love with her and whose blood has an unusually high level of antibodies. He attacks and attempts to rape her, but a corpse reanimates and bites into Max's shoulder. Zoe flees and warns everyone at the party, but nobody, of course, listens. And hordes of the corpses, later dubbed rotters, burst in and kill everyone except Zoe, who escapes through a window only to find the city besieged by rotters. The survivors of the initial outbreak are then sent to refugee camps, and Zoe is sent to High Rock Emergency Bunker, run by Lieutenant Miguel Salazar. 5 years later, High Rock Emergency Bunker has lost contact with the other camps and with headquarters. Zoe and her friend Elise serve as the camp doctors, treating illnesses and using rotter blood samples to create a cure for the rotters, although Miguel believes a cure is impossible. Miguel, at Zoe's urging, sends Zoe, Elise, his brother Baca, Frank, Lucy, Derek, and Thomas on a supply run to retrieve medication from Wittendale University for Lily, a little girl suffering bacterial pneumonia. While taking medication from a professor's office, Zoe encounters Max, now partially a rotter. Horrified, Zoe flees and accidentally attracts the attention of other rotters, but the group saves her at the cost of Frank's life when the rotters overwhelm him. Zoe successfully administers the medicine to Lily. However, Max has managed to enter the camp. Due to Frank's death, animosity between Zoe and Miguel increases. While walking on her own, Zoe is attacked by Max, but signals for help and is rescued by Miguel, Baca, Thomas, Lucy, and Derek. Realizing that Max is not fully a rotter, Zoe convinces Miguel to allow her to use Max's blood to create a vaccine, and Miguel gives her 48 hours to create it, having been convinced by Frank's wife, Ellie. Zoe and Elise then realize they need to test Max's blood on blood samples from live rotters. She convinces Baca to help her by opening the gate to allow one rotter in and take a blood sample from it. Although this initially goes well, rotters burst through the gates, kill Thomas, and infect Elise. Miguel kills several rotters and seals the doors to the compound, and ignoring Zoe's pleas that she can use the vaccine on her, kills Elise. Miguel then tells Baca that earlier he saw Zoe's name carved into Max's arm. When Baca confronts Zoe about this, she tells him about Max's rape attempt. Then Max steals the keys to his handcuffs from Alphonse during a scuffle, and Max begins to taunt Zoe, telling her repeatedly, "You are mine," before freeing himself and attempting to rape her again. However, he is fended off by Baca, Lily's mother, whom Max had previously infected, chases after Lily and kills Derek, and Max kills her and chases Lily to the motor pool. The remaining military personnel arrive, but Max opens the doors and allows a horde of rotters inside, which kills Ellie and Lucy, among several others. In the ensuing chaos, Lily flees outside and Zoe chases after her, with Max in hot pursuit. Baca then attempts to go after them, but Miguel stops and threatens to shoot him at gunpoint, and both are then bitten by the rotters, and Miguel is ultimately killed while Baca manages to escape. Max then follows them into a greenhouse where Zoe, hidden in the mud, disembowels and decapitates him. Zoe and Lily then walk back into the compound where she finds Baca about to commit suicide to prevent reanimation. Zoe, however, convinces Baca she can cure him with the vaccine and injects him with it, curing him as a result. Sometimes later, High Rock Emergency Bunker has been repaired, and Zoe sends a message to any remaining survivors that they have the vaccine, while the rotters' growls are heard from within a nearby forest, and the movie ends. While this is slightly better than Contagium, this is still a pretty fucking stupid movie. It's full of stupid fucking people doing stupid fucking things, and it probably has one of the dumbest female heroes in all of horror history. I mean, she does some really fucking stupid things in this movie, and you wonder how the fuck she can tie her shoes, yet alone survive a fucking zombie apocalypse. This movie also takes a beloved character from the original Day of the Dead, Bub the Zombie, and renames him Max, and basically turns him into a fucking serial killer. Well, a half-zombie serial killer. And it just doesn't work. I mean, you can't take, like I said, a beloved character from a movie and drastically alter their character that much and expect people to like it, which people didn't. Like I said, this is slightly better than Contagion, however, and it does have a pretty good amount of gore, decently done gore. But that's really the only thing this movie has to offer. Other than that, it fucking sucks. This had a budget of $8 million, but unsurprisingly, only brought in $277,922 at the box office. IMDb gave this a 3.4 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 13%. Letterboxd a 1.5 out of 5. And I give it a 1 out of 5. And that brings us to 2002's Halloween Resurrection.
Tomorrow night, you will enter the childhood home of our most brutal mass murderer. The home has been rigged up with several cameras, but for the most part, the audience will see only what you see.
Six friends.
Are you sure they're not just putting us in some house with hidden cameras in the shower?
This is gonna be fun.
Have been offered fame and fortune. That's the American dream. All they need to do,
all the windows will be boarded up and all the doors will be locked shut behind them.
No one will be allowed to leave until the show is over. You stay the night.
Let the dangertainment begin.
Now.
You think this is the one that he used to, you know, do his thing?
The webcast is live.
One flash and you can light up 1,000 computer screens.
You are like this close to getting voted off the island.
The stage is set.
Has anybody else seen this? That worked perfect.
It's all fake. We've been set up.
Only trying to give America a good show.
But the house.
Wait, what just happened? We just lost Bill's camera.
Taking place directly after the events of Halloween H2O, following the murders at Hillcrest Academy, a guilt-ridden and traumatized Laurie Strode has been confined to a psychiatric facility after killing a man who she had mistaken for her murderous brother Michael Myers. As two nurses talk about what happened, flashbacks reveal that a paramedic had found an unconscious Michael in the school before he suddenly awakened and attacked the paramedic, crushing his larynx so that he couldn't speak. Michael then swapped clothes with the unconscious paramedic and left the school grounds and escaped into the woods behind the school as Laurie drove off in the ambulance she believed Michael was in. On October 31st, 2001, after 3 years of hiding, Michael reemerges to attempt to murder Laurie once again, who has been institutionalized at the Grace Anderson Sanitarium, as I said. Expecting his arrival, however, Laurie sets up a trap for him, and after killing two security guards, Michael attacks and chases Laurie to the institution's rooftop, where her trap works and temporarily incapacitates Michael. However, Laurie's fears of killing the wrong person again get the better of her, and when she tries to remove his mask to confirm his identity, Michael stabs and throws her off the rooftop. A year later, college students Sarah Moyer, Bill Woodlake, Donna Ching, Jen Danzig, Jim Morgan, and Rudy Grimes win a competition to appear on an internet reality show called Dangertainment, directed by Freddie Harris and Nora Winston. The students have to spend a night in Michael's abandoned childhood house in order to figure out what led him to kill. However, while setting up cameras throughout the house in preparation for the show, cameraman Charlie is killed by Michael, who has, of course, returned to Haddonfield. On Halloween night, equipped with head cameras, Sarah, Bill, Donna, Jen, Jim, and Rudy enter the house and separate into three groups to search for clues. While Sarah's messaging a friend, Miles Deckard Barden, watches the live broadcast during a party. During the search, Michael suddenly appears and kills Bill. Don and Jim then discover a wall filled with fake corpses and realize that the show is a setup before the former is killed by Michael. At the party, Deckard and other partygoers witness the murder, but only Deckard realizes that it was real. Meanwhile, Freddy enters the house dressed as Michael in order to scare the competitors. He is then followed by the real Michael, whom he mistakes for Charlie. When Rudy, Sarah, and Jim find Freddy in the Michael costume, he reveals the scheme to them and begs them to cooperate, telling them that they will all be paid if the show works out. After Freddy leaves, the trio decides to gather up the rest of their friends and leave, and Jen discovers Bill's corpse, and Michael decapitates her in front of Rudy, Sarah, and Jim, who soon realize that it isn't Freddy. Michael then proceeds to kill Jim and Rudy before chasing Sarah upstairs. Locking herself in a bedroom, Sarah begs for Deckard to help her, and as the other partygoers realize that all the murders were real, Deckard begins to message Sarah on Michael's location to help her avoid him. Sarah then runs into Freddy just as Michael finds them and stabs the latter. Sarah runs into the tunnels and finds an exit leading to the garage, where she discovers Nora's body. Michael again arrives and attacks Sarah, but a still-living Freddy finds them and fights Michael as an electrical fire starts in the garage. This is a particularly hilarious fucking scene, even though I'm not really sure that it was planned to be fucking hilarious, but I'll get into that later. After electrocuting Michael, Freddy carries Sarah to safety, leaving Michael to die in the burning garage. Later, Freddy and Sarah are interviewed by the local news, during which Sarah thanks Deckard for saving her life. Meanwhile, Michael is presumed dead and his body is taken to the morgue. However, as the coroner prepares to examine his body, Michael suddenly awakes, and the movie ends, of course, leaving it open for yet another fucking sequel. The fact that Jamie Lee Curtis herself didn't feel the need for a sequel to H2O because she felt that Laurie's ending fit perfectly fine in the previous film should be enough to steer you away from this fucking movie. By this point, the makers of this franchise had pretty much milked Michael for all they could, and it was really starting to fucking show how much of a decline the franchise had gone into. The cast is mainly made up of, back then at least, big-time celebrities, most noticeably Tyra Banks and Busta Rhymes. And it was quite obviously done this way to try to get people to come back to the franchise after having so many shitty movies in a row, even though the movie previous to this one, Halloween H2O or Halloween 20 Years Later, really was more of a return to form for the franchise. But once again, they went and ruined it with Halloween Resurrection. And it fails in pretty much every department. I mean, there's some pretty bad acting. The death scenes are pretty fucking boring and predictable. And Tyra and Busta are quite obviously slumming it in this movie. But it does contain one redeeming point, And that's the scene I was talking about earlier, where Busta Rhymes is fighting Michael in the inflamed basement. But it's fucking hilarious. And like I said, I don't know if this was intentional or not, but it's hilarious to see Busta Rhymes try to fight fucking Michael Myers with fucking Kung Fu. It's the best fucking scene in the entire fucking movie. So that should tell you how much the rest of this movie really does suck. But like I said, that's really the only redeeming point in this movie. Other than that, it's pretty fucking stupid. Especially the story. it's next to The Curse of Michael Myers. It's probably the worst in the entire franchise. This had a budget of $15 million and somehow managed to bring in $37.6 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 3.9 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 12%, Letterboxd a 3 out of 5, and I give it a 1.3 out of 5. Next up, we have 2015's Llamageddon.
Between Earth and space.
Llamageddon.
I'm not going to spend much time at all talking about this piece of shit, because it's probably one of the worst fucking movies that I'm going to talk about this episode. And it literally took me 10 times of watching this to get past the first 5 minutes of this movie. It's that horrible. But basically, it involves a killer alien space llama who lands on Earth and attacks a house party thrown by stupid fucking people that can't act worth a shit. It's a fucking terrible movie, guys. The acting skills of all those involved are pretty much non-existent. It seems like they were just pulled right off the street and were reading from the script off screen. And they're very robotic in the way they act. And it's just fucking terrible. The special effects are fucking terrible. And it's also really pretty fucking boring. You know, it might seem like a lot might actually be going on in this movie, but there really isn't. It's pretty fucking boring. And it's just a stupid story, stupid fucking plot, stupid fucking movie altogether. But it's quite obvious that this movie doesn't take itself very seriously. But unfortunately, no one involved in the movie did either. And it's a viewing experience I'd rather not repeat for a 12th fucking time. For some reason, IMDb gave this a 4 out of 10. Didn't even chart on Rotten Tomatoes. Letterboxd an astounding 2.2 out of 5. And I give it a 0 out of 5. Next up, we have 1986's Maximum Overdrive.
Hi, my name is Stephen King.
I've written several motion pictures, but I want to tell you about a movie called Maximum Overdrive, which is the first one I've directed.
Wow.
What in the dickens is going on around here?
A lot of people have directed Stephen King novels and stories. And I finally decided if you want something done right, you ought to do it yourself.
Who was driving it?
I don't know.
It was my first picture as a director, and you know something? I sort of enjoyed it.
What is going on?
I don't know!
I just wanted someone to do Stephen King right.
You want a war? You got one.
I just want to get the hell out of here.
So come and spend some time with me and my friends at the Dixie Boy. Spend some time in the dark.
Please don't let me in the dark.
I'm gonna scare the hell out of you. And that's a promise.
You're gonna get us in an awful lot of trouble, man.
We already in trouble.
Maximum terror.
Jesus coming and he is.
Maximum King.
Maybe tomorrow will be our world again.
Dino De Laurentiis presents Stephen King's Maximum Overdrive.
Based on Stephen King's short story Trucks, found in the short story collection Night Shift, the movie opens as the Earth crosses the tail of a comet. Previously inanimate machines suddenly spring to life. An ATM insults a customer, and a bascule bridge rises during heavy traffic, causing all vehicles upon the bridge to fall into the river or collide. Chaos sets in as machines of all kinds begin attacking humans worldwide. At the Dixie Boy truck stop just outside Wilmington, North Carolina, employee Duncan Keller is blinded after a gas dispenser sprays diesel in his eyes. An electric knife then injures waitress Wanda June, and arcane machines in the back room electrocute a customer. Cook and paroled ex-convict Bill Robinson begins to suspect something is wrong. Meanwhile, at a Little League game, a vending machine kills the coach by firing canned sodas point blank at him, and a driverless roller compactor flattens one of the fleeing children, but Duncan's son Deke manages to escape on his bike. Newlyweds Connie and Kurt stop at a gas station, where a brown tow truck tries to kill Kurt, but he and Connie escape in their car. Deke then rides through his town as humans and even pets are brutally killed by lawnmowers, chainsaws, electric hairdryers, pocket radios, RC cars, and an ice cream truck. At the Dixie Boy, a black Western Star 4800 sporting a giant green goblin mask on its grill runs over Bible salesman Camp Loman after a red garbage truck kills Duncan. Later, several big rig trucks then encircle the truck stop. Meanwhile, a Mack truck pursues Connie and Kurt, but they make it crash off the side of the road as it explodes. They then arrive at the truck stop and try to pass between the trucks, but their car is hit and overturns. Bill and Brett Graham, a hitchhiker, rush to help them, but the trucks attack them. The owner, Bubba Hendershot, uses M72 LA rockets he had stored in a bunker hidden under the diner to destroy many of the trucks. And Deke makes it to the truck stop later that evening and tries to enter via the sewers, but is obstructed by the wire mesh covering the opening. That night, the survivors hear Loman screaming in a ditch, and Bill and Kurt sneak out to help him by climbing through the sewers. Deke then finds Loman and believes he is dead, but he suddenly jumps up and attacks Deke. Bill and Kurt rescue Deke, and a truck chases them back into the pipe. The next morning, a Caterpillar D7G bulldozer and an M274 mule drive to the truck stop. The angered Hendershot uses a rocket launcher to blow up the bulldozer, but the mule fires its post-mounted M60 machine gun into the building, killing several people, including Hendershot and Wanda. The mule then demands, via sending Morse code signals through its horn that Deke deciphers, that the humans pump the truck's diesel for them in exchange for their lives. The survivors soon realize their own machines have enslaved them, and Bill suggests that they escape to a local island just off the coast, on which no motorized vehicles are permitted. While the crew is resting, Bill theorizes that the Comet is actually a quote-unquote broom operated by interstellar aliens that are using Earth's machines to destroy humanity so that the aliens can repopulate the Earth. During a fueling operation, Bill sneaks some grenade onto the mule's vehicle, destroying it, then leads the party out of the diner via the sewer hatch to the main road, just as the trucks demolish the entire truck stop. The Green Goblin truck pursues the survivors to the docks, managing to kill trucker Brad when he falls behind. After Bill destroys the truck with a direct hit from an M72 LA rocket shot, the survivors then sail off to safety. A title card epilogue explains that 2 days later, a UFO was destroyed by a Soviet weather satellite, conveniently equipped with a Class IV nuclear missile and a laser cannon. 6 days later, the Earth passes out of the comet's tail, and the survivors are still alive to tell the tale. While this is the first adaptation that Stephen King directed based off of one of his own stories, he has fully admitted that it's a terrible movie, and that the reason it's a terrible movie is, once again, and he's fully admitted to this, he was coked out of his mind when he was directing this, so that's why it's such a terrible fucking movie. I'm a fan of Stephen King movie, or Stephen King adaptations, as are many people, but the people who actually like this movie are the minority. To watch this, it requires a massive amount of disbelief, as a lot of the story elements really don't work. Like, for example, one of the couple's cars in this movie works perfectly fine, you know, nothing, doesn't try to fucking attack anybody, while everything else is fucking going haywire and hurting or killing people. So why is it that this one car is the only car in apparently the entire world that isn't doing what every other piece of machinery is doing? But there is a redeeming point to this movie, and that is that it's pretty fucking brutal in the attacks on humanity, and nobody is spared being brutally murdered, not even kids. Not to say that kids being murdered in a movie is a particularly good thing, but usually it's pretty taboo to kill kids in a movie, but this one definitely doesn't shy away from it. But other than that, and this is a terrible movie, and as I said before, even Stephen King has admitted to this being a horrible fucking movie. But it does have kind of a cool soundtrack, with a lot of songs from AC/DC in it. This had a budget of $9 million, but flopped at the box office and only brought in $3.5 million. IMDb gave it a 5.4 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 15%, Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a 1.3 out of 5. And that leads us to the final film of the part 1 of the Golden Toilet Bowl Awards, and that is 2019's Antrim.
This is the forest where the devil landed when he was cast out of heaven. And at that spot, we'll find the entrance to hell. The Antrim. The deeper we dig, the more the forest around us becomes darker.
with each layer that we pass. Deeper in how we'll be.
Opening with a legal notice that states, by continuing to watch this film, you agree that the producers of this film have made you aware of the history and dangers associated with Antrium. The producers, distributors, cast, crew, unions, and theater management on all levels are released of all liability for any event that occurs to you during or after your screening, including but not limited to illness, injury, mortal danger, or death. If you disagree in any way with this notice, you must leave the theater now. In 1979, a film named Antrim, shot in English but apparently of Bulgarian origin, is submitted for inclusion in a variety of film festivals, but none accept it. After each rejection, the various festival directors die under suspicious circumstances. Several years go by during which the film remains unseen until it mysteriously appears at a theater in Budapest in 1988. During the screening, a fire, initially believed to be the result of a faulty projector, burns the theater to the ground. Investigators later determine that audience members set the fire themselves. The film again goes unseen for many years until it is screened in a theater in California in 1993. Prior to the film, a concession stand worker doses popcorn with LSD, and the combination of the drug and the film results in a riot during which a pregnant woman is killed. Following the screening, all copies of the film apparently vanish, and it earns a reputation as being cursed. In 2018, a copy of Antrim surfaces, prompting a documentary crew to make a short film on its history and impact. Although the origins of the movie remain unknown, scientists and film experts who examine a 35mm reel determine that, among other unique properties, the film utilizes disorientating sounds and subliminal imagery. The documentary crew further determines that unrelated black and white snippets of an apparent snuff film have been spliced into the original movie by a third party. The documentary then pauses so that Antrim may be presented in its entirety for the first time in 25 years. We then move to a story that concerns siblings Orly and Nathan, whose pet dog Maxine was recently euthanized. After Nathan asks if Maxine went to heaven, their mother tells him that because she was a bad dog, Maxine has gone to hell. In a flashback, it is revealed that Maxine attacked Nathan for no apparent reason, which resulted in her being euthanized. Traumatized, Nathan begins experiencing disturbing dreams and visions of demons. In an effort to ease his mind, Orly claims to have obtained a grimoire from an imaginary classmate named Ike, whom she claims is versed in the occult. Using the book, in fact a sketchbook Orly has filled herself with arcane drawings and quote-unquote spells, she takes Nathan to a nearby forest locally renowned as a place for suicides, telling him that it is the place where Satan fell to earth when he was cast out of heaven, and that if they can find the place where he landed, the pair can dig a hole to hell and rescue Maxine. Orly then guides Nathan through a series of rituals and rites, intending all along to arrange for Nathan to discover Maxine's collar in the woods as a sign that they have saved her soul. As the day progresses, Orly is disturbed to find that her spells are having an apparent effect on the real world, conjuring actual infernal figures. Additionally, the pair accidentally interrupt a man attempting seppuku and obliviously pass by the rotting corpse of a suicide near their campsite. Their first night in the woods, Nathan slips out of the tent and sees a boat being rowed in a nearby stream by a figure resembling Charon, who ferries a nude woman. He likewise hears a rattling chain that he attributes to Cerebrus. The next day, Nathan and Oralee stumble upon a pair of cannibals in the woods who capture and cook people alive inside a giant iron statue of Baphomet, including the man whose suicide attempt they earlier interrupted. when the cannibals become aware of their presence, Oralee attempts to take herself and Nathan to safety by abandoning their camp and rowing downriver in the boat Nathan saw the night before. The pair both end up falling in the water, but Oralee and Nathan make it to shore, only to realize they have moved in a circle and are back at their camp. As they hide for the night, Oralee confesses the ruse to Nathan, but he claims to have met Ike. Nathan further tells Oralee that Ike told him not to trust her. The next morning, the cannibals capture them and attempt to cook Nathan, but Oralee escapes her cage and frees him. As Nathan flees, Oralee obtains a gun and shoots the cannibals to death. In the woods, Nathan stumbles across a dog with its paw caught in a bear trap, and he frees the animal, taking it as a sign he has freed Maxine from hell. The end title card appears on screen, and the film abruptly resumes, following Oralee as she runs through the woods, pursued by demons and experiencing violent hallucinations. She hides in the pair's tent, aiming her gun at the entrance, and as Nathan approaches, a panicked Oralee opens fire, and the film ends. We then cut back to the documentary, which resumes shortly after this, with scholars observing a ruin seen throughout the film belonging to a demon named Astaroth. Examples of the ruin appearing subliminally throughout the film are shown as historians recount tragedies attributed to the demon throughout history, and the movie ends. While this isn't the worst of the lot of the movies that I talked about in this episode, it's actually much better than most of them that I've talked about. As I've mentioned before, I am not a huge fan of found footage films, which the second part of this basically is, the first part being about the documentary crew making a documentary about this movie. And then, like I said, it cuts to the story of Oralee and Nathan, and then it cuts back to the documentary once again. Said I'm just not a big fan of found footage. And, all the rumors about this movie being cursed are all false. I mean, if you type up the theater fire into Google and all that kind of shit, you'll find out that it never happened, which isn't really a surprise. But like I said, this is much better than most of the movies I've talked about on this episode. There are some rather creepy parts in this that kind of give an eerie power, I guess is the best way to put it. But a lot of this seems to just drag on and on, and it gets quite boring at times, even though they do their best to make it creepy. And the scares are more of kind of like a trippy scare, because they're supposed to be hallucinations. But it just really doesn't work when it comes to scares, because it's too trippy to be scary, I guess is the best way to put it. And that's really kind of a letdown when you think of all the hype this movie got. Like I said, it's not the most terrible out of the movies I've talked about, but it's not super great either. IMDb gave it a 4.9 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a surprising 75%. Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5. And I'm going to go ahead and agree with Letterboxd and give it a 2.5 out of 5. And that just about wraps it up for part 1 of the Golden Toilet Bowl Awards. As always, you can reach out to me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. Alright guys, I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you next time.